This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, October 31st, 2012. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, communities across the eastern U.S. begin recovery from Hurricane Sandy as power cuts and flooding persist in some areas. With 6 days to go until the U.S. election, voters are paying close attention to the candidates' response to the disaster. And we'll hear from residents in Nigeria about their views on how the outcome of the U.S. presidential election could affect Africa. Those stories and more coming up after this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. In the wake of powerful storm Sandy, power outages are affecting residents from North Carolina north through New England and as far west as Michigan. More than 6 million households are without electricity, according to the latest stats from the Department of Energy. Sandy has now weakened to a low-pressure system over western Pennsylvania, but it continues to wreak havoc on several states. West Virginia has seen heavy snowfall. The snow has caused several deaths, including a candidate for the state legislature, who was killed by a falling limb. The number of dead from Sandy continues to rise, more than 60, according to Wednesday afternoon reports. Deaths in the Caribbean have topped 70. Overall, unemployment in the Eurozone has reached the highest point in its history. Statistics released today from the European Union show that 11.6% of people in the zone are unemployed. From Madrid, FSRN's Robert Downs reports.
There are more unemployed people in the Eurozone than ever before. But those 18.5 million people without jobs aren't spread equally around the continent. A few countries, mainly Spain and Greece, far surpass their European neighbors. Here in Spain, the unemployment rate is more than 25%, with more than half the country's youth out of work. Greece is in a similar situation. The jobless rate also rose in Germany for the first time in 3 years, according to the country's Federal Labor Agency. That said, the seasonally adjusted rate is still below 6%, which stands in stark contrast to other European countries. These statistics come at a period of calm in Europe. For the past few months, investors have speculated over the possibility of a full sovereign bailout in Spain. But interest rates on Spanish debt have fallen to a manageable level, and Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy has maintained that a bailout is not necessary. That's not the case in Greece, which is being forced to enact further austerity measures as it's set to receive another $40 billion bailout. To protest, the country's largest unions have called for a 48-hour strike next week. A general strike in Spain is scheduled for November 14th. Robert Downs, FSRN, Madrid.
In other Eurozone news, a coalition of NGOs under the name Federation of Human Rights is urging European lawmakers to place restrictions on imports from Israeli settlements. The group concludes in a new report that Europe is playing an economic role in maintaining the illegal settlements and is importing more from these settlements than from Palestinians. NGOs are pushing for the EU to stop the imports or, a minimum, change EU trade law to ban goods from settlements being labeled as made in Israel because, quote, under international law, settlements are not part of the state. The movement towards international intervention in northern Mali continues this week. Officials from the African Union, the West African Economic Bloc, ECOWAS, the EU, and the UN are meeting in the Malian capital Bamako to devise a strategic plan. On Monday, U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton was in Mali's northern neighbor, Algeria, trying to rally support for military operations to stem the influence of Islamists who have taken over the region. Algerian President Abdelaziz Bouteflika has been reticent to support non-diplomatic options, but shifted tone after a meeting with Clinton, who praised Bouteflika's knowledge of the region.
As to the many complicated factors that have to be addressed to deal with the internal insecurity in Mali and the terrorist and drug trafficking threat,
France 24 reports Bouteflika would support intervention from African troops only, as long as his military is not directly involved. And finally, a loosely Halloween and weather-themed story. With the coming cold of winter, wildlife officials are once again expecting to see a flare-up of white nose syndrome in North American bats. The syndrome first appeared in eastern New York in 2006. The disease causes a white fungus to appear on the bat's nose, wings, ears, or tail. It's spread from bat to bat, and it's suspected that humans can also transport the fungus. Gabrielle Grader, biologist with the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission, says the spread is made more prominent as greater numbers of bats seek shelter in caves during the winter.
They're just sitting ducks. Their bodies are shut down. Their immune system is shut down to some degree, and they're sitting there vulnerable. They're cold, and the fungus just gets a chance to grow all over them.
Surveys find 5.5 million cave-dwelling bats have already been killed by the disease. The U.S. Forest Service has closed hundreds of caves and abandoned mines to human traffic in the West, trying to prevent the spread of the fungus. And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. Residents across the U.S. East Coast began a slow recovery from the devastation of Hurricane Sandy today. Even as some areas remained flooded, millions were without power, and transportation was disrupted in major metropolitan areas. More than 60 people were killed by the storm in the U.S., according to the AP. In Maryland, Connecticut, Pennsylvania, Delaware, and elsewhere along the coast, flooding and power outages continue to affect communities. President Barack Obama toured New Jersey's battered coastline this afternoon with Governor Chris Christie. National Guard troops continued to conduct search and rescue in the area. Across the Hudson River in New York, most bridges reopened and some bus service resumed, but the subway system remained closed after heavy flooding. New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg said it would still take days to recover from the extensive damage.
Many people's lives were turned upside down by the storm, and you have my word that everyone in city government at every level is working 24 hours a day to get this city back on track, including working with the MTA and Con Ed to meet the two biggest challenges that we face, mass transit and electric power.
Bloomberg said nearly 700,000 residents in the New York area still did not have electricity. The group Riverkeeper is urging residents to avoid flooded areas due to pollution and is warning of contamination from leaking fuel tanks, sewage overflows, and other toxic sources that could pose a danger to the public. With just 6 days to go until the election, voters are watching how the candidates respond to the natural disaster. FSRN's Alice Olstein reports.
Both President Barack Obama and Governor Mitt Romney announced temporary suspensions of their campaigns this week. But a supposed Romney hurricane relief event in Ohio Tuesday included the same promo video and music playlist used at his rallies and stump speeches. At the event, recorded by MSNBC, reporters asked him nearly a dozen times to clarify his position on the federal government's role in disaster relief, but received no answer.
Governor, would you eliminate FEMA if you were president?
The uncertainty over the Republican ticket's views on FEMA and other government agencies coordinating disaster relief has several roots. In a GOP primary debate this summer, Romney said he would prefer the federal government have no role at all.
Every time you have an occasion to take something from the federal government and send it back to the states, that's the right direction. And if you can go even further and send it back to the private sector, that's even better. We should take all of what we're doing at the federal level and say, what are the things we're doing that we don't have to do?
We cannot
afford to do those things without jeopardizing the future for our kids. It is simply immoral, in my view.
Additionally, in May, vice presidential candidate Paul Ryan led House Republicans in approving the Sequester Replacement Reconciliation Act, which protected the military budget by slashing federal disaster aid, among other domestic programs. Other Republicans have also expressed opposition to federal disaster relief, and conservative think tanks, including the American Enterprise Institute, back these positions, saying decentralized and privatized efforts would be more efficient. But several disaster relief experts, including Professor Sondra Schneider at Michigan State University, disagree.
I don't think the evidence suggests that there has been massive mishandling or corruption or any kind of, you know, massive inefficiency in the way the government does the relief process. And during the vast majority of disasters, not only the federal government, but state and local governments do a pretty good job of dealing with emergency situations.
Voters have had 4 years now to see how President Obama tackles disaster relief, from flooding and drought in the Midwest, to tornadoes and wildfires in the South, to Sandy and other hurricanes on the Atlantic coast. This week, the president swiftly mobilized federal resources to impacted states, and kept in close contact with East Coast governors and mayors, starting before the storm hit on Monday. President Obama spent Wednesday touring Atlantic City, one of the hardest hit areas, with New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, and will return to campaigning on Thursday. Obama campaign manager Jim Messina told reporters on a conference call that Obama is trying to strike an appropriate balance between his campaign and presidential duties.
Until we got a handle on the scope of this disaster, the president's job, and this was his judgment, was to remain in Washington and face-to-face touch with those who were responsible. And, you know, we do have an election on Tuesday, so we owe it to the folks to make the final arguments, and we're going to do that.
No matter who wins Tuesday's election, the budgets of federal relief agencies are in jeopardy. The Romney-Ryan budget does not exempt FEMA from deep across-the-board cuts to discretionary programs, which could slash between 20 and 40% of its funding. President Obama's proposed 2013 budget cuts FEMA by 3%. Additionally, the upcoming budget sequester mandated by last year's Budget Control Act would cut nearly $900 million from direct disaster aid. To avoid this scenario, Congress must agree on more than $1 trillion in budget cuts before the sequester is triggered at the end of the year. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
The dominant two-party system in the U.S. has long posed a dilemma for voters dissatisfied with the narrow choice on the ballot. Some progressive advocates are backing a voting strategy put forth by RootsAction.org, in which voters in closely contested states cast ballots for the Obama-Biden ticket, but those in so-called safe states vote for third-party candidates. For more, we're joined by Frances Fox Piven. She's on the faculty at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York and author of many books, including Challenging Authority: How Ordinary People Change America. Welcome to FSRN.
Glad to talk to you.
Explain the concept behind strategic voting in this year's election.
Well, strategic voting is an effort to make it possible for people to vote for the candidates and programs of third parties, minor parties, without, in a sense, losing their vote, without making their vote insignificant. And the idea is to do this by having committed Democrats partnering with committed Republicans, and thus eliminating the danger that the vote is negated, if particularly in states where that are not swing states, where everybody knows who is going to win the majority of the vote. Those are the blue states and the red states on the electoral map.
So the outcome, and this is how the Roots Action Campaign words it, would be a vote of protest against Obama in those more secure states, a vote for Obama in swing states. How does the current voting system affect this strategy?
Most of the country is majority Democrat or majority Republican. The majorities may not be very large, but they're very certain. And therefore, those states don't count in this election. You won't find the candidates visiting them. You won't find the propaganda money pouring into those states. But, you know, in most of the developed world, that much of the population is not ruled out of the election. Most of the developed world, we don't have two-party politics. We don't have winner-take-all politics. That is the arrangement in the United States. It's the result of what's called plurality voting. It means that in a state like California or New York, if one party gets and is assured of 51% of the vote, they get all of the representation. That means they get all of the Electoral College votes.
I want to go back for a moment to the concept of strategic voting and how it could play out practically in this election. By taking a look at Florida, it's a close state. Projections show tight polls between Romney and Obama. There are 29 electoral votes there, so important to the overall tally. We recently had on our program PETA Lindsey. She's a presidential candidate for the Party for Socialism and Liberation. She's a former activist with the Answer Coalition. She advocates putting the needs of working people first, strong anti-war stance. Now, under strategic voting, a voter in Florida would not cast their ballot for her, even if that voter agreed with the ideals of the campaign, because it's so close there. How are third-party candidates to make gains if voters have to compromise on their choices?
Well, we'd have to change the basic system of counting votes for the purposes of representation. We'd have to have some form of multi-party proportional representation so that the ballot of that prospective voter would count toward getting representation. Right now, it doesn't count at all. I mean, I can vote for the Party of Liberation, the Party of Transformation, whatever. What difference would it make? It wouldn't count.
So one question is, does a voter need to wait until there's broader structural change to cast that vote, or does that vote for a third-party candidate push in the direction of reforming the structure?
Well, I'm not sure of the answer to that question. I myself tend to invest more in social movements, protest movements, than in trying to reform the basic system of representation that we have in the United States. But I congratulate those who try.
You mentioned the role of protest movements or social movements. In a recent article in The Nation, you write that some in the progressive communities question whether movement politics or electoral politics is more effective. And you write that actually that's the wrong question. Both are needed. And without both, neither is effective. Take the example of Occupy. Would Occupy be an example of this?
Yeah, I think Occupy is not going to. Most Occupy activists are so disheartened by American electoral politics, who can blame them? It's disgusting that they won't work in the election. But what they are doing does have an effect on the election. When the issue of extreme inequality doesn't emerge, then, you know, people can be won over on all the cliches that we speak, America the Beautiful, in electoral campaigns. But once the issue is raised, then the price for the allegiance of these voters is also raised. And that's what a protest movement can accomplish.
Frances Fox Piven is the author of many books on social movements and democracy, including Who's Afraid of Frances Fox Piven? The Essential Writings of the Professor Glenn Beck Loves to Hate. She spoke to us about strategic voting and electoral reform. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
In California, voters will decide next week on 11 statewide propositions. One of them, Proposition 32, would ban corporations and unions from using payroll deductions for political purposes. It's proved controversial. Unions say it's a stealth campaign to limit their influence, and recently the measure drew a last-minute infusion of cash from outside the state from a secret funder. California is now suing to require the Arizona nonprofit to reveal its donors. FSRN's Max Pringle reports.
Petition signatures put Proposition 32 on the November ballot. Backers of the measure say it will make government more responsive to the needs of everyday citizens.
Special interests have a stranglehold on Sacramento. They exert a tremendous amount of influence over lawmakers and dictate how public policy is shaped and crafted in this state.
Jake Suski is a spokesperson for the Yes on 32 campaign.
It means that lobbyists can't sit in back rooms and craft deals with politicians in exchange for money.
Suski says Prop 32 accomplishes this in three ways. First, by banning direct contributions to candidates from unions and corporations, then banning government contractors from contributing to candidates, and finally, banning unions and corporations from using payroll deductions for political purposes. But Prop 32 opponents say the ballot measure is an attack on labor, masquerading as reform. Several labor and environmental activists gathered recently at a No on 32 rally in San Francisco. Lisa Hoyos is California director of the Blue-Green Alliance, a coalition of labor and environmental groups working on green economy initiatives.
And so what this sort of cynical proposition does is say that will no longer be a way you can spend your political dollars. And they say it's going to impact corporations too, but corporations don't use payroll tax deductions to, you know, spend on super PACs and the other things they do to buy political influence. So it really singles labor out and would really eviscerate the voice of working families in the political discourse in California.
Both sides have poured more than $100 million into the campaign, according to an analysis of state data from the campaign finance watchdog group MapLight. That's more than the most expensive Senate race. Businessman and attorney Charles Munger is Prop 32's biggest donor, chipping in about $22 million. MapLight's analysis shows the California Teachers Association is the largest contributor to the No on 32 side, spending more than $20 million. The money's mainly going to TV and radio spots, both for
Vote Yes on 32. Cut corporate and union money ties to politicians.
And against.
Prop 32 is deliberately written to look like campaign reform, but it's not. It actually gives more power to Wall Street, big oil, and those secret campaign super
Recently, the campaign finance reform advocacy group Common Cause urged the California Fair Political Practices Commission, or FPPC, to investigate a recent $11 million contribution to the Yes on 32 campaign from what Common Cause identified as an Arizona-based dark money nonprofit called Americans for Responsible Leadership. State officials say it's the largest ever anonymous out-of-state contribution. State law requires full disclosure of out-of-state donors to California political campaigns. Ann Rovell is chair of the California Fair Political Practices Commission. She says the FPPC asked the law firm representing Americans for Responsible Leadership for documents related to its contribution, and
they did not give us any documents, so we went to court to compel them, essentially, to provide the documents to us.
Rovell says Americans for Responsible Leadership told her that the FPPC's request is unconstitutional. A law firm representing the group has reportedly worked with organizations linked to billionaire oil magnates Charles and David Koch, who've poured millions into conservative campaigns around the country. California Common Cause says Prop 32 supporters' lack of candor is ironic.
Obviously, the Yes on 32 campaign has been out there saying that this is going to stop special interest money. And we think it's absolutely hypocritical that they turn around and take special interest secret money that is unwilling to disclose its donors.
Philip Ung is policy advocate for California Common Cause.
This is not how proponents of campaign finance conduct themselves.
If the Superior Court finds that Americans for Responsible Leadership violated state law, it can order the group to turn over the relevant documents to the FPPC. The FPPC will then determine if the contribution violates the law. A ruling is expected later this week. Max Pringle, FSRN, San Francisco.
People around the world are watching the U.S. presidential race closely in the final days before voting, and that's the case in Africa. Even though the continent received little mention when President Barack Obama and his Republican challenger Mitt Romney debated foreign policy in their final confrontation. In Nigeria, Africa's leading oil exporter, some people are looking at both candidates for signs of U.S. foreign policy towards Africa. They say the U.S. has strategic economic and security interests there, and the candidates' positions could affect millions of residents. FSRN's Samuel Okoya reports from Lagos.
Many in Africa have been following the build-up to the U.S. presidential election with interest, partly because President Barack Obama's father was of African origin. Sylvester Odion Ahene of Lagos State University says the president's ancestry might be his most significant connection to the continent, as neither Obama nor Mitt Romney have much to offer Africa politically.
If you understand the policy of the West vis-a-vis Africa, the slogan, you know, for it is to say no deal. There has never been a deal for Africa. Obama has not done anything for Africa in the last 4 years. And so I'm not expecting that Obama, you know, will take a greater interest in Africa, aside security concerns. Neither will a Rumi give a damn about what happens in the continent.
When discussing foreign policy in debates and on the campaign trail, the presidential candidates have neglected many issues important to African people. Kenneth Akali, an analyst on international relations, said he wasn't surprised that Africans were neglected by the candidates.
Africa will feature only when there is a pressing concern. The major thing is about having security of access to resources that come from Africa to the U.S. And so far, there is no major concern with regard to sourcing raw materials, mostly oil that come from Africa. That's why it hasn't really featured in the U.S. elections. If they can get the resources, the people don't really matter.
Key U.S. economic interests in Africa include oil, which it gets from countries like Nigeria and Angola. There is also a growing need for columbide tantalite, or coltan, from the war-ravaged Democratic Republic of Congo for use in electronic items like computers and cell phones. Additionally, some African countries in the Horn of Africa and the eastern part of the continent are strategic in the U.S. war against terrorism. Many, like Philip Jackpot from Nigeria's oil-producing Niger Delta region, say the U.S. should refocus its foreign policy in Africa to better serve people living in areas where it has economic or security interests.
I will expect America's foreign policy to be refocused to particularly Africa, where their businesses, their economic interests, even their security concerns have actually affected lives. Their companies like Chevron, continue to pollute in our own Niger Delta, and the interest that's generated in the United States and among policymakers there is totally insignificant compared with what, for instance, happened when BP spilled in the Gulf of Mexico.
Some Nigerians, like Odion Ahene from Lagos State University, don't have much faith in the Republican candidate for president, Mitt Romney, either. He questions Romney's diplomatic skills and experience.
Romney calls a picture of a fine person. But in terms of his utterances, he appears to have racial bias. In terms of, his criticism of Obama, and talking about, Americans bred in Americans, for me, it's a racist bias. And I think that, of course, that also has implication for his policy should he win the American, presidential elections in terms of relations, to other countries aside of the United States. So that's basically the way I see that.
But Joy Agbonifo, another Nigerian who has closely followed the U.S. presidential campaigns, says Romney might make a good president.
Mitt Romney have so far put on a good fight against President Obama. I think he has a lot of support across the country. If he's not good, he wouldn't have been so popular. Since the presidential contest is going to be very close, I think he might be the next president of America.
If President Obama is re-elected, some hope it will once again emphasize that ethnic minorities should have the chance of becoming president. In most African countries, the largest ethnic groups dominate political power, making it difficult for anyone from a minority group to become president. Sam Olukoya, FSRN, Lagos.
And that's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Catherine Cobb. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.